Hello, this is producer Bree, and thank you for joining us on Chasing Shadows. Today we are doing a little different kind of episode. It's just Josh and I in the studio today.
Hello.
Hi, and we're going to be talking a bit more about the Holy Grail.
Yeah, so just to give everybody a little bit of an update on the episode that was supposed to be going on today and what we ended up doing. So we had Big River Paranormal in for an interview. For those of you who listened to last week's episode, Robert and our tech guy Nathan and I, we went to Port Gamble, Washington for a paranormal investigation with Big River Paranormal, and it was awesome. We had a great time, and so we had them in for an interview as a follow-up to that investigation, and as it happens, we had some technical difficulties and are not able to use the audio from that interview. So we are terribly sorry to Big River Paranormal, and we would love to get them back. I think we're going to go to a ghost conference up in, I think, November that they were talking about. So we'd love to get them back on to have them finish that follow-up, as it were, because we were not able to use the audio from the follow-up interview. But we did get the evidence from the audio recordings that they had. We all had a chance to listen to it. And so we're going to put that up on our website, which we're going to talk a little bit about later, and so that we still have the info from that interview and can give it to you guys. So, yeah, that's what we got going on today. I'm here with producer Bree, and we are going to be going beyond the Da Vinci Code. That's where we're at today. A few weeks ago, we had our first Da Vinci Code topic where we kind of looked at some of the stuff that was actually in the movie The Da Vinci Code and the book to see if there was any good evidence. And we talked a little bit about it and the story it's based on then. But it has been a quite a popular episode, and so we decided, since we did not have the interview we were going to do, then producer Bree and I were going to get into the studio and record an episode for you guys, because this is the topic that I did a lot of research before getting into the show, as you know, Bree.
Yes.
And really almost kind of led to the show. And led to, you know, the show as a project. We are not joined by our regular co-hosts today, McLean and Bain, who are normally here. Our co-hosts, Eric McLean and Robert Bain, are not able to join us today, but they are here in spirit. They will be back for next week's episode. So we got producer Bree, and since it's you and me, Bree, I wanted to kind of give our listeners a little bit of a history of the show. We don't have a ton of episodes up, but we've actually been doing it for a while, and the show really came into a concept a couple years ago, and the very first iteration of the show was going to be producer Bree and I being the host of the show, and you had another job that you started at the time and weren't quite able to be a co-host. So it's good to have you back on. I feel like this is kind of a prequel episode.
Yeah, it's nice to be on. I've really enjoyed being able to be a little bit more hands-on now that I am no longer at that job. And, you know, we talk a lot, and that's kind of where this comes from, you know.
Yeah, that's where the show came from.
Going off on tangents.
Yeah. And we're thought, hey, we've got these great conversations, and we love having them. And I think, you know, when people joined in, they thought the same. And so that's what the show was born out of. And we were originally going to do it as a podcast. And through pure happenstance, we got in connection with KXRW and some of the people there who were looking for shows at the time. And as they say, the rest is history. We've been doing the show for over a year now, actually. It's been over a year. Like I said, we don't have a ton of episodes up because on KXRW, we were just doing monthly episodes. Mm-hmm. But we had a lot of people express interest in the show and, you know, love going on investigations with us. So we decided to up our content. So, you know, we love doing it and we want to bring more content to you guys. So we're to the once a week typical podcast schedule. So for anybody listening right now, just to let you guys know, our episodes, we put them up on Wednesdays currently. They're up, you know, beginning of the day on Wednesdays, and we have a new one every week so far. So every Wednesday you can look for a new episode. We have our episodes up on a few different channels, and that's growing too. That we're not done. We're going to be on more. We are on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, iTunes. We're on Google Podcasts. We're on Stitcher. And we have a couple episodes on SoundCloud. We're going to have the rest on SoundCloud as we go. So we're going to have all the episodes up on that. And even from there, there's a couple we want to do as well. So that's where you can listen as a podcast. You can also listen on the website xray.fm or through the KXRW website. And then, of course, the main way you can listen is on the radio. And we don't do all of our episodes on the radio, but we do episodes on KXRW as well. So for those of you who are local to the Portland-Vancouver area, you can catch us on 99.9. And we are on in Vancouver and Portland on not every Wednesday morning. Right now, we're actually upping how much we're on. So you can find us. It's about every other Wednesday, but our podcasts are every week. So just to give everybody a rundown of how they can listen, that's a little bit about that. And also social media and websites. That's something we've talked about quite a bit on the show. We mention it, I think, almost every episode. And just kind of wanted to level with all our listeners a little bit and talk about that because, you know, we mentioned we'll put that up in the show notes or, you know, we've got a survey coming up online. But some of the feedback we've been getting, we want to make it easier to find and we want to make it easier to get to. So I wanted to just throw a timeline out there for all our listeners. It is when this episode airs, it's going to be Wednesday, August 14th. We're going to have all of our social media revamped by the end of this month so that we have at the very least links to all the show notes for every episode up the day it airs so that it's easy to find. And on top of that, producer Bree and I have been working on our website. And that website is, I'm trying to make it as simple as possible, www.chasingshadowsradio.com. And currently, it's kind of under construction. If you actually go there, it's a live site. You know, we've worked on a little bit, and it's a live site. So you can go there to listen to some of the episodes, although we're working on getting all the episodes up, descriptions for all the episodes, and then mainly the show notes. The show notes is the big thing. So we want to get those up, and then also we'll have some fun stuff on there about us and different affiliates and links you can go through there. So ChasingShadowsRadio.com is our website, and if you go to the website in August, it's just be aware we're still under construction and working on getting everything set for that, but by September we should have everything rolling and looking good. So thank you for sticking with us on that, and if you've gone looking on the World Wide Web, the giant World Wide Web for us, and have had a hard time, then I promise you we are going to make that easier because as a show, we're growing. We're growing quite quickly. I think with the extra episodes we've been doing, it has really brought in more listeners. And so with that growth, we want to make it easier for people to engage and interact with the show because that's why we're doing it, is to kind of bring you guys along for investigations that we were going on anyways. So that's kind of a breakdown of our social media and website and where we're going with it. So also, before we get started, I also wanted to give a shout-out to one of our listeners. This guy's a shadow chaser through and through, shadow chaser at heart. Actually, he has been... So on our very first episode, we told a story about Eric and I doing some ghost hunting when we were in high school. This guy was there with us on that ghost hunt and is probably our biggest fan is very into a lot of paranormal and supernatural and conspiracy-based topics as well. So we want to give a shout-out to Brandon Parkey and his wife Brianna Parkey because they also welcomed a shadow chaser, or what may be a shadow chaser, into their lives and had... they had their baby on Friday, August 9th, little baby Rylan Joy. So I just wanted to give a shout out to them, give them a congratulations, and we look forward to hearing about baby Rylan and are very excited. Want to give a shout out to that shadow chaser. So on to our topic for today. And that is the Da Vinci Code, kind of. That is the Da Vinci Code, kind of. Now, we're using the Da Vinci Code as the title of the episode. Kind of, that's what we did on the last one. And that is most people's entry into the topic, is the Da Vinci Code. And if you caught the last episode, then you might have a little bit of background already. If not, I suggest going back to listen to it. It's got some good information and will give you a foundation for this episode. Because we're going to talk a lot about the same things we did in that episode, but we're going to go deeper into them, and so it's helpful to have that that foundation for going into this episode. So we're going to jump in. Bree, The Da Vinci Code. So this is a treasure hunt movie through and through, and I haven't had a chance to ask you a lot of your favorite. You know, we talk about movies and TV shows and video games and media on this because that often shapes our view of the paranormal mm-hmm. or mysterious, which just I would follow under the maybe the conspiracy category. But what's your favorite treasure hunt movie, Bree?
I don't normally watch them. Honestly, I think with you is when I watch them most. I never really have been big into the treasure hunting just because I think I always thought I was too mature as a kid, which is pretty boring.
A kid who doesn't like treasure hunts, what is that?
Right. Yeah, I played accounting as a child, so I definitely lost a bit of imagination there.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had to pick, I would probably say The Goonies, just because I like it for everything that it is.
The Goonies is so solid.
Exactly.
That's a great
choice. Well, and
it's
for so many reasons. It's not mm-hmm. because of treasure hunting. It's just one of those things where, like, I love it as a great movie, and it happens to be a treasure hunting
movie. Right, right. Yeah,
and that's
exactly
what the kids get inspired on. And I think I think part of that, too, is, like I mentioned, it's the kids. I think that I'm more apt to watching kids find treasure than adults.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Not to be disrespectful, because up until the last couple of years, I kind of always viewed treasure hunting stuff as, like, kids stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah, totally. Yeah,
not a lot of
yeah.
basis in reality.
Right, right.
As we started doing a show more, you know, and you talking to me about your research and stuff, I totally see the appeal going beyond that.
Sure.
But that was just not really a perspective that I had considered before.
Right, and it's not like there's a ton of actual, you know, like real-life treasure hunts yeah. going on. And when they do, they're typically more on, like, the academic side.
Yeah, and that's what I think I've noticed, too. Because, you know,
yeah.
see stuff like Nicolas Cage and, you know, all these things. And I'm like, and you know how I feel about
National Treasure.
Cage, so.
I think you're giving treasure hunt movies a bad rap because I'm of sorry. Nicolas Cage.
Probably. Probably. I really dislike him. He was probably, like, the first, like, cause, I mean, when that movie came out, I was, like, in middle school, I think. And so, like, I was like, oh, yeah, this movie. And then I watched it, and I was like, Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. Well, and National Treasure came out about the same time as The Da Vinci Code. And to me, almost felt like a family-friendly version of The yeah. Da Vinci Code, because it's kind of the same story.
Yeah.
And that you have a secret society or organization that is protecting a treasure throughout the ages, and, you know, from there you've got now somebody who's got to go find it for whatever reason for the plot, and they're kind of the same thing
yeah.
with the Da Vinci Code using the Priory of Sion and National Treasure using the Freemasons.
Yeah. For me, like, when I think about secret society stuff and my appeal to them, I don't know if it's because I messed up, but I'm more about, like, the cult side.
Sure, sure.
So I'm like, if there's going to be a secret society, there better be some cult rituals happening.
Right, absolutely. And I would almost say that the Freemasons maybe are one of the reasons for contributing to that, because a lot of their stuff behind the scenes is very ritualistic. It's kind of like, it almost feels like those pagan ritual type things. Mm. And I can see how that would really creep in and inform somebody's perspective on something like that. Because it, you know, a secret society feels like a cult sometimes. And some of the things that have become public about quote unquote secret societies feel very ritualistic. Some of the, you know, the known examples are the Bohemian Grove or the Skull and Bone Society at Yale, which we've had many famous politicians or many well-known politicians that came from there. So I totally get that.
I like
that.
Geocaching.
Geocaching is fun. That's treasure hunting. Yeah, totally. That's treasure hunting. I think just going on a hunt for something, you know, scavenger hunts, little stuff like that. I think naturally people have a tendency to go yeah. find things that they're looking for. Huh. And sometimes those things happen to be, you know, important historical artifacts. All right, so we're getting on to our topic today. And mostly it's going to be centered around a small French village, which if you listen to our first episode on the Da Vinci Code, you will recognize as Rennes-le-Château. And Rennes-le-Château was the site of really not much. It's just a small village in southern France, but it was where a priest in the late 1800s went and allegedly found some hidden parchments. And those parchments then led him to, in whatever way, gain considerable wealth. And he never revealed what was in those parchments or what might be going on. But there was some evidence that he had more wealth than he should have for a priest in his position at the time in that area. So that's where the mystery kind of starts in its modern forms. And it goes back much, much further when you start to look at some of the history and some of the things that have been put forward by books like Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So Just to give a quick, Robert's not here, but I'll give a quick Robert rundown for the whole Rennes Le Chateau mystery, if you haven't gone back to listen to the Da Vinci Code episode at this point. But there was a priest in the late 1800s who remodeled a church, and when he remodeled the church, ran into some parchments. Over the course of the next few years, he started gaining wealth and built a few things on the side of the church that would that seemed like he had more money than he should, which was in particular two things. One, a stone tower called the Tour Magdala, dedicated to Mary Magdalene. The other was his house. It was a rather lavish house for the village called the Villa Betania. And he was in there with his housekeeper. I believe his housekeeper's name was Marie Denaud. But I'm not fully sure on that. We'll have to put that in the show notes just in case we need to fact check that one. From there, it was picked up again in the 1960s. Now, here's where I actually have to give a correction, because we were in the last episode, we were talking about the book Le Trésor Maudit, and I said it was written by Philip de Chérissy. I was actually wrong on that. Kind of. The book was written by Gerard de Sède. Its original version was called L'Or de Rennes, Ou la vie insolite du Béranger Saunier, curé de Rennes-le-Château. Or The Gold of Rennes, The Strange Life of Béranger Saunier, Priest of Rennes-le-Château. It was then published as a paperback entitled Le Trésor Maudit de Rennes-le-Château, which is just The Accursed Treasure of Rennes-le-Château. And then a revised and updated version was then released in 1977. For the sake of the last episode, it was Le Trésor Maudit. And I said it was written by Philip de Chérissy. It was actually written by Gerard de Sède. And completely just whiffed on that one. However, Philip de Chérissy was the alleged author of the parchments that were shown in the book. Mm-hmm. So essentially the ones that they claimed that the priest found was written by Philip de Chérissy. So he was involved, but not the author. So just a quick correction on that. However, from there, those books were published. Henry Lincoln picked it up in the 1970s. He was a writer and actor. In the UK, and he picked it up. He made a couple documentaries about it, one being named The Shadow of the Templars, and from there he got with two co-authors who then wrote Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And that was when it really blew up. Holy Blood, Holy Grail put forth the idea that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, and that they had children, and the descendants of those children were of the Davidic line, and continued on in France as the Merovingian kings, and that they had descendants that were living today.
What was that last name?
That would be the Merovingians. The Merovingians were a, I don't want to say a group of kings, was a family of rulers in the French area, or in the area around France, but we're talking a long time ago. We're talking, I don't know the exact dates, I want to say like 500 or 600 AD. Really, really, we're talking over a millennia ago. But they're very well known, they're very documented, they actually did exist. That's not in question. But what Holy Blood, Holy Grail theorized is that the Merovingian kings were descendants of Jesus. Okay. So that's when it came onto the scene in a big way, and then from there the Da Vinci Code happened. And then it really blew up, that was worldwide success, a movie with Tom Hanks. And that's when the idea of that really, really hit the mainstream and hit the ground running. And there was even some court battles in between the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Mainly, in doing a little more research on that, mainly it was just about the credit. Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code, claimed that he did all the research himself when it was very, very clearly more based on the work in Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And one thing we didn't talk about too much in the last episode was the word Sangreal, which is translated to Holy Grail, that if you move the G one over, then it switches to Holy Blood. Or, excuse me, not Holy Blood, but Royal Blood. And it switches to Royal Blood. So, you know, that's kind of where it got to the mainstream. And since then, there hasn't been too much on it. The topic has died down since the Da Vinci Code has. There were a couple documentaries made in the mid 2000s, or the mid-aughts, which we're going to talk about a little bit. But that's a very, very quick rundown of everything that happened there. Okay, so what we're going to do with the episode today, and we're going to be on that story. We're going to be on the Da Vinci Code. And it's going to be kind of two different things going on. One is I'm going to be telling my personal story with the research, because I've been doing research into this for about 15 years now, which, given my age, is about half my life, and which is pretty substantial for an amount of time to be doing research into something without any actual results or having been in the area. So I'm going to tell my little story because it's also the story of a little bit of how the radio show came to be, but also want to dive into other things that seem to be related to the topic, because we talk about Rennes Le Château, we talk about the priest, Béranger Saunier, but there's so much more going on in the area. There's so much more going on in the area. It's so deep. It's so, so deep. And so we're going to touch on some of those topics today. And we're going to go into some of them and probably just spend a few minutes on each and going into those to give you guys an idea of, if you're interested in the topic, some things you can look into as well. And then beyond that, talk about some things that are going on with the Priory of Sion and the modern day Priory of Sion and people who claim to be part of the organization, or at least imply that they're part of the organization. So that's where we're going with it today. So Bree, what was the most interesting part of the Da Vinci Code episode for you? What was some of the most interesting topics? Is there anything you wanted to learn more about?
Definitely. I found it really interesting. Obviously the whole concept of the bloodline of Jesus Christ. I personally, with my, lack of religious affiliation, believe that there's a really good chance that that might be the case. And so, it's just one of those things that it's so interesting to me, and it just shows so much about society that there's so much going into either maintaining that there is or isn't that bloodline, and what it really means, and I think you and I talked about it shortly after the last episode where, we talked about so if it did ever come out, I don't think that that would really change anything because people are so set in their ways. I don't think that anyone would ever really change their opinion based on knowing that.
Yeah. No, one way or the other. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't really matter what it is, in my opinion. But I found a lot really interesting in what the Da Vinci Code alluded to as far as the association with a matriarchy and what that would mean, and that that's part of something that's being suppressed.
They're focused on the sacred feminine and the ideas of the sacred feminine.
Well, and then not just that, but so then Mary Magdalene, they try to discredit her, say that she was a prostitute and all the things, which, not too much unlike 2019. So, and then also with the thought that the child would be a female, they had a daughter, and, mm-hmm. Jesus stands for so many different things and was leading the people, and that was during a time where it was definitely more of a patriarchal society, mm-hmm. and if sure. now this woman comes up and is supposed to be your leader or, a person that you're supposed to take order and direction from, and mm-hmm. that she's Jesus's bloodline, that would mean that all the men would have to bow to a woman.
And yeah, absolutely. And
that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And they even talk about that in the Da Vinci Code. Yeah. They address that in this. There's a scene where Tom Hanks is talking, or rather Robert Langdon is talking to Lee Teabing. And he said, Teabing says, oh, and her name was Sarah. And one of the characters is surprised that they even know the name of the girl. And Tom Hanks says, well, if that's true, that would add insult to injury, mm-hmm. because it's a female. It's a female who's carrying on the bloodline. And that would kind of go against the very patriarchal thoughts exactly. of the Catholic Church. And they talk about the Malleus Maleficarum and, stuff like the Inquisition, where women were persecuted and treated in a terrible way. And I can't emphasize enough how much that's an understatement, that they were treated poorly. And so, that is definitely something that is prevalent in the Rennes Le Château story. And because of that, the Da Vinci Code, that there is a focus on the sacred feminine. And that, mm-hmm. There's some – that Mary Magdalene as a character is almost a – inspiration almost. At the end of the Da Vinci Code, Robert Langdon goes and kneels at her tomb. Because that's kind of the pilgrimage for people who are going to learn the truth, is that the truth is that Mary Magdalene was this powerful character in the right hand of Jesus, and she was a woman, and that there should be some equality, and that if he was married to her, then it may have been, not so much that the husband was ruling everything, but that it was kind of a co-equal thing, as it should be.
What would that mean for all of Christianity, too? Not saying that if you're a Christian, then you only value a patriarchal home, you know, and you, but
oh sure, yeah, and we're not you know, no, digging against Christianity like or anything like that. But what would it mean if one of the earliest teachers, what would it mean if one of Jesus's apostles was a woman? You yeah. know, what would it mean in terms of like women being priests or women being having mm-hmm. more roles in the church and in the administration of the church mm-hmm. in the Vatican?
Exactly.
So that's I'm glad you bring that up because that continues into the Rennes Le Chateau side of things. Very specifically, the symbolism of the pentacle. Not the pentagram. Pentagram is very associated with witchcraft, but a pentacle, just a five-pointed star. And there's a couple associations with that, with the planet Venus, but also the goddess Venus, and that it kind of seems to represent the sacred feminine. In symbolism and history across the world, that's not a terribly new thing. But the character of Jacksonier in the Da Vinci Code, that's what he puts on his chest as a star. And so we can see those things, and I'll talk a little bit more about some geometry in relation to building of churches in the area and how that ties in with the symbolism of the pentacle and how that kind of goes from there. So the sacred feminine is a huge theme throughout the Rennes Le Chateau and Da Vinci Code legend. And all that goes through it. So we're going to take a look. What we're going to do for this episode is we're going to go touch on some of the things that are tied to the area, specifically to Rennes Le Chateau and some of the things around it, so that if our listeners have specific things they want to go look into for this topic, they can jump into them because there's so much. So to start that, we're going to jump back to before the Knights Templar even were disbanded as heretics. For those who listened to the last episode know, the Grand Master of the Knights Templar, Jacques de Molay, was burned at the stake in the early 1300s because the Templars were declared as heretics, and that was the group who allegedly found some stuff in Jerusalem, and was one of the reasons they went on their crusade there. So if we go back even before that, in the area there is a famous castle called Montségur.
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 To use the correct French pronunciation. And for those who know their European history really well, there was a group that was there named the Cathars. I'm not going to go into the Cathars too much, just to say that they were I don't want to say pseudo-religious group, but they were kind of a sect of Christianity who were in the area at the time. And just like the Templars, they were labeled as heretics and were kind of hunted down. And so one of the big things that happened early on here in the Rennes Le Chateau area is that Montségur, there was a big siege. And this siege was kind of a big deal. It was in 1242, and there was a big, I would call it an army. There's about 10,000 troops that sieged the castle. And it went until March 1244, and that is when the castle finally surrendered. At that time, a lot of the Cathars were burned en masse. There was a bunch of Cathars that were burned, just kind of like the Templars were. And anybody who decided to denounce the faith would not be burned, you know, kind of typical heretical fashion.
Yeah.
And so Montségur kind of became famous for that. The current Montségur that is there is not the same castle. During that siege, or after that siege, rather, they tore it down. The one that is there was built up over the next three centuries. But that is the story. Now, as that story goes, and I believe this is talked about in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, is that there were three Cathars who decided to scale the walls and climb down the mountain, because Montségur is actually on the top of a mountain. Like, it's very well fortified and very hard to get to because it's at the top of a mountain. And the legend goes that three of them climbed down, and nobody knows what they climbed down with. And there, in the early 1900s, there was a French writer named Josephine Peladon, and he proposed that the treasure was actually the Holy Grail, and that Montségur was actually a castle that was written about in the 13th century Grail romance Parzival, which is one of the earliest Grail legends. And so that's kind of one of the earliest connections of Rennes Le Chateau to the Holy Grail, is that they believe that the Siege of Montségur had to do with that, or at least inspired Parzival, which, you know, that's a very early Grail legend that's kind of set the scene. So that is kind of the origin not the origin. That is one of the earliest things that went on that really made the area, or was one of the really big things that happened in the area. And since then, it's inspired legends, you know. Since then, there's been a bunch of stuff that has come out of it. It's involved with, they mentioned, I'm not sure if they mentioned the Cathars or not on the Da Vinci Code. I don't think they do, just the Knights Templar. But it was around the same time as the Knights Templar and there was other stuff going on. So there's still some Cathar symbolism that can be found in the area and some theories about the organization staying around after. But that was one of the earliest Grail legends from the areas that in the 1200s during that siege, that the Cathars had the Holy Grail there when they were sieged. Three people left during the siege to go take it to a safe place. And that how is that is maybe not how it got to the area, but one of the stories of it while it was in the area. So that was in the early 1200s. There's not much more action on it that we've learned about until the 1900s. Well, really the late 1800s with Baron J. Saunier. But then we get into that period where there's more people doing research on it. So one of the other very interesting connections to Rennes-le-Château, at least with some of the research into the area, was a person named Otto Rahn. And he's one of the early people, he's one of the people from the early 1900s who was involved, but closer to World War II. And that's specifically because he was a German writer and actually an officer of the SS. Which is kind of really surprising and not something that's talked about a ton in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, or, you know, Rennes-le-Château mythos, but he is involved with it, and very particularly with Grail myths. And so we're not going to dive into this at all because we don't have nearly the time to go into it, but for those who are, you know, up to date on their occult and World War II history, the Nazis and Nazi Germany was very, very intrigued by the occult. Very, very intrigued.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's yeah, it's all the meth. There was a group called the Thule Society, I want to say, who literally were just like devoted to finding paranormal things and,
really?
And like building up. I think it was like a chi type thing, like energies inside of you. Absolutely. No. And then there was this whole group of the
SS.
Like
they didn't have that much spare time with all of their conquests.
With all of their conquests. Well, there was very specific people who were devoted
That's
to
true.
It. Right.
Was it like parts of the actual like army? Like, I don't hey, your job
no.
is to do this.
Well, I don't believe that the Thule Society was actually attached to the Nazi government or administration or military in any way. But they were, you know, people who identified as Nazis who were doing, yeah. you know, that kind of activities, those kind of research at the time. And they were very much into it. There's also a lot of theories about Nazi technology and trying to do things like, There was a very concentrated effort to look for religious artifacts and things that might be considered supernatural.
Well, especially I feel like, I mean, it didn't make sense at first when you said that, but thinking about it, like, that kind of stuff could wield power, whether it be just influential power or actual power, depending
oh, right,
on what
exactly,
it is. And
right.
so it's, I feel like, more of just like a, hey, let's get these things so they're on our side and they're not in other people's hands. And, you know, if you've got a religious artifact, you know, if they did find something like that that was so impactful to Christians, mm-hmm. it's like, hey, now you're going to listen to anything we do because if we don't – or if you don't, we're going to destroy this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, whether or not it was symbolic or whether or not they actually believe there's something going on, I mean, the Nazis were the ones who believed in the Aryan race beforehand and that we were descended from a superior race who was different from us. You know, so they had some crazy ideas and some of these things played into that.
I sense an episode coming up.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that'll definitely
Hitler
be an episode.
Plus the supernatural.
Yeah, oh, there's we could go so deep on that. That's no, why I say yeah. we can't get into it on this episode because there's okay. not nearly okay. enough time. But what I can say is that one of those people who was actually officially in the military, he was an officer in the SS. And he was tasked with, or rather he was, I don't know if he was tasked with it, but he was doing research into the area, specifically with connections to Parzival and the Cathars in the area, what we were just talking about. So he was looking at connections of that and how it related to the area and what might actually be there. And that he believed that the keys to their secrets was that it was somewhere in the area, particularly beneath the mountain peak where the fortress of Montségur was. So he was really, really in on that idea and was one of the early people to help perpetuate that idea. And he wrote a couple books. One of them was The Crusade Against the Grail in 1933. The other was Lucifer's Court in 1937. Mm. After he wrote his first book, he was actually, I mean, we're talking about like getting the attention of Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, like well-known Nazi names. This dude was doing research that got their attention. And they were like, they really want, you know, they were looking for religious artifacts at the time. And they thought, oh, this guy's got something. Now, here's the thing. They were the Nazis. They were terrible people and they did terrible, terrible things. And for Otto Rahn, he could not come to terms with that because he was allegedly a homosexual.
Oh.
Right. And so that did not work out.
Playing for the wrong side.
Yeah, that did not work out well being a Nazi. So he wrote his second book in 1937. And he was dead by 1939. He was assigned to be a guard at the Dachau concentration camp as punishment for a drunken homosexual encounter that he had, allegedly. But from there, he resigned in 1939 and...
died that year?
He died that year.
By his own hand?
He was the thought is that he was killed by the SS.
Yeah. Well, especially if he's already got all that like research that they wanted, yeah. They want to just keep it to themselves, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. He was found frozen to death on a mountainside in Austria. His death was officially ruled a suicide. Yeah. So there was some stuff going on with Otto Rahn. It seems to be such a weird thing because the Nazis are like the quintessential evil.
Yeah.
But he was doing research into this thing, this, you know, religious artifact, and you know, his whole thing was like, hey, you know, what am I supposed to do? My countrymen are doing this, and I have to eat. I have to do something. And while I can't necessarily square those types of thoughts away myself and say I would do the same thing, he does seem to be somebody who were at least against the philosophy of the Nazis, but were using their resources to his benefit.
So that... makes me wonder about his personal effects after, which I'm sure that they either got destroyed or were taken by the Nazis. Because if he didn't fully agree with everything that they were doing, it's hard for me to believe that he would have led them straight to it or given them all the information that he had.
Oh, that's a really good point, that he might have withheld some of it.
Yeah, or, you know, skewed something just to keep them slightly off track, you know, keep it valid enough where he is valued by them. But, you know, if he understands the implication of them getting hold of that and he already is like, hey, these people are not good people.
Yeah, absolutely.
He wouldn't just – I don't think anyway. And this is from I know.
Yeah, I would say I would hope so, but I don't know that. It might even be the opposite, that he had research that he wasn't giving to them.
Yeah, and that's
and that
what
he
I mean.
Was killed and that – well, but they may have found it and had it.
Exactly.
Or,
that's what I was like. Wonder what his personal effects were.
Exactly.
If they were taken,
so I don't know what the possibility is. It may be none, but maybe he had other research that didn't come to light and that the Nazis did get. You know, so that was a really interesting connection to Rennes-le-Château in the area because this was happening, you know, at the end of Béranger Saunier's life, but not that far. That was only a couple decades after he allegedly found the parchments.
Really?
Yeah. So that was the late 1890s. I guess this would have been the 30s that he was writing his books. So we're, you know, in the time frame of being not that far past when Béranger Saunier died.
Yeah.
And although it wasn't specifically related to the stuff necessarily that Béranger Saunier found, if there's that many things going on in the area, then that might kind of point to underlying things that are tying them together. Although I don't necessarily see any specific. A lot of people think the Cathars are what's tying them together. You know, maybe Béranger Saunier found a Cathar treasure, or the Cathars were the ones who were in charge of the treasure. Yeah, maybe the Cathars were the ones who were in charge of the treasure, and, you know, it was two different people independently finding out what was going on with them. So that's Otto Rahn. I actually share a birthday with Otto Rahn. His birthday is February 18th.
What?
Not that I particularly enjoy sharing a birthday with a Nazi officer.
No, but I mean, it's interesting that you guys both did research on the same thing independent
sure.
of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
I share a birthday with Ulysses S. Grant, and I have zero in common with him, so at least there's something.
Yeah, totally. So that's Otto Rahn. That's some of the interesting stuff with him. So once we go from there, then we get into the more modern day stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're jumping into back to Henry Lincoln Philip DeCheresi, Gerard DeSed, and some of those guys, some of those players in the game. And so it starts with the book, Lord of Ren, The Gold of Ren, and that gets written. Henry Lincoln picks it up. Okay, so we've talked about that a couple times already on the rundown and on the last episode. But there's some things to jump back to, and that's mainly with Henry Lincoln. And that is in regards to the riddle that he found. And that is where, for me personally, the focus has been a lot of. Because when I jumped into this topic, it became very clear very quickly that there were a lot of different things going on. And there very likely were people in the modern day who were trying to inform those opinions and get people to think a certain thing about the area. And so the riddle, and for those who don't remember it, I'll give a quick... I'll repeat it really quickly for those who did not listen to the episode. But the riddle is, Shepherdess, no temptation, that Pusson tenures, hold the key, peace, 681, by the cross and this horse of God, I complete or destroy this demon guardian at noon, blue apples. And the complete or destroy, the reason I say complete or destroy, it doesn't actually say I complete or destroy, it says j'achève, which is I achieve. So the context could be either I complete or I destroy, depending on the context of the actual riddle. So it could be either of those things. So that's the riddle. And where it gets interesting is jumping in, well, with both of the painters, really. But that's where it got the most interesting for me, because my thought when jumping into this was that if there were painters from the 1600s, which David Teniers the Younger and Nicolas Pusson, Nicolas Pusson, if they had known about this and if they had included some stuff in their paintings about it, that couldn't be faked. You couldn't go back and fake something from the 1600s. So if there was something that was going to be likely to be found, that's where I wanted to look for it. So over the course of my life, I've spent far too much time looking at those paintings.
I was going to say that, like, as far as that riddle, if you ever were concussed, potentially, I would probably have you repeat that to me.
Yeah, yeah.
To see if you were or not, because it's so ingrained in you.
Yeah, for the listeners, you can't actually see, but that's fully I've got that thing memorized.
Yeah,
down pat.
Like,
no
that's,
problem.
Like, any time of day. Like,
just spout it off. Shepherd is no temptation that Pusson tenures hold the key. Yeah.
It was funny. I could see us doing that in front of somebody too and be like, repeat the riddle. And like, right. Yeah, he definitely is right. Concussed. But no.
Yeah, yeah.
No, he's good.
Well, and, we mentioned one of our fellow shadow chasers, Brandon. I was talking to him recently. He made a comment about how he remembers in high school, I used to have those paintings all over my wall. So you'd walk into my room, and it was like one of those conspiracy things where all the strings tied together. I had that with the paintings.
Did you seriously have the strings?
No, I didn't have the strings. No.
Oh, dang it.
I had them next to each other. I had them, like, butted up next to each other, and that would be...
In the landscape?
Yes, and that will become apparent why when I explain my theory, which is the first time we'll talk about my theory about those paintings on the show. But I had a very specific reason for putting those paintings together. So it's been that way for a long, long time, and that's where I've put the majority of my focus. So there's Pusson and David Teniers, and they only give the last names, which is actually kind of an important fact. So, first off, I have to apologize to any listeners who are getting me on my pronunciations. I am not super great with him. I think in the last episode I said Tenier. It's Teniers. He's not French. He's a Flemish painter.
Flemish?
Flemish or Dutch. I think he's actually a Dutch painter.
Where are Flemish people from?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot and I don't know. But I believe he was actually a Dutch painter.
Okay.
One of a similar heritage to you as well.
What?
So there are two David Teniers. David Teniers is the senior and David Teniers is the younger. And it's believed that David Teniers the younger is the one that the riddle is referring to, because he made some paintings, or a series of paintings, called The Temptation of St. Anthony. He made a ton of them. And they're all a little bit different. So he painted a few versions of St. Anthony during his temptation. Now, David Teniers is not the only person to paint the scene by any means at all. He made a lot of them, but it is a very, very, very popular subject matter in paintings. And essentially, it is about St. Anthony being tempted by different things, and how... when he was tempted, he decided that he, you know, wasn't going to give in to whatever temptation might be. And in the case of the paintings, it's often put in, it's often tied to like little monsters and stuff, little monsters and creatures that he's being tempted by, kind of demonic figures, metaphorically speaking.
They're really cute though. I've seen them.
Oh yeah, totally. Today you might think that, you know,
that's some, how they would get me.
Yeah, I'm Monsters like, Inc. So yeah, right, right. But basically, the temptation of Saint Anthony, the depictions that David Teniers did are very similar in that they appear to show Saint Anthony going into a cave while surrounded by being tempted, while surrounded by things that are tempting him. Okay, there is, however, a painting where Saint Anthony is sitting with another person, another character in the painting, and they and it's a story as well from the life of Saint Anthony where a bird is bringing them bread, and it is a painting of Saint Anthony by David Teniers the Younger that has no characters being tempted in it. So it's believed that that's what the riddle is referring to. The David Teniers' Temptation of Saint Anthony, where they're not actually being tempted. Personally, I think maybe. Something that I've never actually put out there publicly, but I think is something that's a possibility, is that there is a painting. And now, this is going to be kind of a weird one because I've found little tiny things where I don't have the full source or knowledge of, but seem to be maybe related. So there is a painting by David Teniers the Younger where there is a central female character who is walking into a cave that is seemingly the same cave that Saint Anthony is walking into. And she has a knife in her hand and some things that she's holding in her dress, but Saint Anthony is not in it. And that, personally, I think that's as good of a possibility as any for the no temptation part of the riddle. So there's the possibility of that one existing. Now, looking into that now, if we go online now, producer Bree actually found that there was a painting almost exactly like that one that was donated by, you said it was a Dutch aristocrat?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was a painting donated to the London National Gallery.
Yes.
And it was donated by a Dutch aristocrat, which makes sense. Teniers was a Dutch painter.
Yeah.
And he donated it. And so that's that same cave. And that's very similar to the one that I saw in Into the Unknown. So in recent years, it's actually, you know, you can find some other paintings of that cave.
The same type of thing. Sorry.
Yeah. No, please, please.
No, it's the same type of thing. Woman with a giant blade in her hand. It looks like there might even be, the way that the shadow is, there may be blood or it's just the shadow.
Right, right.
And she's carrying things in her skirt.
And there's like a Cerberus, basket. Three-headed dog. Yeah. I mean, all these metaphorical demonic creatures almost.
Yeah.
Beyond the Temptation of St. Anthony, there was that painting that I found that looked like the same cave. Now, looking into it now, there is, you know, more resources available online than when I first started. We actually found that that painting exists online. We're going to put it up on our website and going to get it on the show notes. This painting is called The Gates of Hades. And I would say go on and make a judgment for yourself. But it includes all of the, or it includes very, very similar creatures as the Temptation of St. Anthony, and the cave looks to be the same. Now, I know caves probably don't seem that different, but these are scenes that David Teniers painted that all kind of focus around a cave and focus around going into a cave and different features around that and the things that are in that cave. And there is at least one where Saint Anthony isn't being tempted, and in my opinion, there are at least two that we can find that don't even include Saint Anthony but are of the same setting.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because those two ones with the woman, other than a few minor details, they're the exact same. But they're from different perspectives. But
yeah, kind of flipped.
Exactly. So in one, the Cerberus is on the left side, and one it's on the right side. Mm-hmm. But more or less all of the creatures are just flipped, which is really interesting. And if there was some sort of message, you have to think, what does that indicate?
And not only that, but like, I mean, we could look to see, like, maybe he was trying to paint similar images for different people so that they weren't too similar. You know, just to kind of play devil's advocate, we're at the gates of Hades, play true. A little devil's advocate. and you know, maybe that's what was going on, but he painted it so many times. So it seemed to be an important thing. And then beyond that, Béranger Saunier, we mentioned him at the beginning. One of the things he did with his newfound wealth that he got was remodel his church. with inexplicable imagery. And on the altar, there is the figure of Mary Magdalene kneeling in a cave, and it has a skull and a cross that is similar to some of the Saint Anthony paintings as well. So there's some very interesting connections, even just in mentioning No Temptation in 10 Years. Now, I talked about 10 Years first because that's, I mean, those are fun, interesting connections. There's not really anything concrete there. That's very interesting things to go off of. Like I said, I encourage our listeners to go on and make an opinion for themselves. That's not, by any means, that's not all there is to the 10 Years stuff. And there's some very interesting things about some 10 Years paintings being stolen, and maybe find some 10 Years paintings that, you know, if you put them together, they look like the same image, those kind of things. But that's the 10 Years side of things. So now we're going to jump over to a more well-known, I mean, this guy's a master. He's a Renaissance master. And that's Nicolas Poussin. And I almost don't even know where to begin. I almost don't even know where to begin because there's a lot. So I'm going to keep it as brief as I can because we've got a lot of stuff to cover today in this one. But Nicolas Poussin. In the riddle, it's Shepherdess, No Temptation, that Poussin 10 Years hold the key. So it's thought that No Temptation goes to 10 Years. They're both mentioned second. And Shepherdess is what connects to a Poussin painting. Now, that could be a couple things. Poussin made a lot of paintings. He was very famous. He made paintings for a lot of really famous and powerful people in Europe at the time. So just to tell you about Poussin, he was alive in the early 1600s. A very, very prolific painter. He was associates with a lot of other famous painters at the time. And when they mention Shepherdess in the riddle, there are mainly two paintings that come to mind, both of kind of the same title, and that's Et in Arcadia Ego, or The Shepherds of Arcadia. Now, the first version is kind of simple. There's not a ton to it. But the first one has a couple of shepherds by a tomb, and the tomb has a skull on it, and inscribed in the tomb are the words Et in Arcadia Ego. And that translates from Latin to And in Arcadia I, which seems to be an incomplete sentence. And that, I mean, kind of adds another riddle, because it's just a tomb with this odd Latin inscription on it that is incomplete. And so there's that painting, and then there's the main event, and that is The Shepherds of Arcadia. And that is probably Poussin's most famous painting. It's very, very well known. It is a painting of three figures. Yeah. It is a painting of three figures in the foreground, and they are also around a tomb. And it's a kind of a square tomb, and there is a mountainous landscape in the background behind it. And in this painting, there is at least one character pointing to the tomb, and the tomb says the same thing, And in Arcadia I. Now, there's a lot of interesting things about this painting. We talked about Henry Lincoln. One of the things that he did was have Christopher Cornford from the Royal College of Arts in the UK. He had him examine the painting. Now, I'm not going to claim that I know the ins and outs of the findings that he had, because I am not an art history expert by any means. But what Christopher Cornford found, that it used a type of pentacular geometry that was not very common at the time, and that there's actually, if you follow the geometry in the painting of all the different things, and extend out past the painting, it actually creates a pentacle. And we'll put the picture of this up online. But it seemed that there was at least something different being used here than typical for other Poussin paintings or other paintings by other masters at the time. And so that pentacle was what really intrigued Henry Lincoln, because that wasn't common at the time. And beyond that, Henry Lincoln also had the painting x-rayed, because there was something about the staff that he thought was really weird. And what he found was that the staff was made before the other things in the painting, and that the actual measurement of the staff was quite important to the overall composition of the painting, and that pentacular geometry that Christopher Cornford found in the painting. So, you know, already with just a little bit of work look into it, Henry Lincoln found some very, very interesting things about this painting. So from there, I believe, I want to say it was Gerard de Said, after he had told him about this riddle, or rather, I want to say that when Gerard Desaid told him about the solution to the coded parchments and the riddle, the Poussin riddle, that he also told him that about the Shepherds of Arcadia painting, because that was what was mentioned. Not only that, he said that that tomb in the painting actually existed in Rennes-le-Château. And that tomb was the Pontils tomb, P-O-N-T-I-L-S. It's French, so it's probably pronounced Pontil or Pontil, Pontil tomb. But that is where Henry Lincoln went. And Henry Lincoln was filming some of his documentaries there. And from there, he actually looked at the landscape and said, the landscape that is in the Shepherds of Arcadia actually is a real landscape. And it's at Rennes-le-Château, and you can see it from the Pontils tomb. Like the viewpoint from the Pontils tomb is of the same background landscape. However, the Pontils tomb was not known by just him, and it was a little more famous at this time. And while they were filming one of their documentaries, they took a lunch break, and when they came back, the tomb had been destroyed.
What?
The tomb does not exist anymore. So nobody can go to it anymore. It doesn't exist, so you can't go and see. So far as I know, there was no inscriptions on it that said "et in Arcadia ego" or anything like that, but mainly that it existed in the background landscape was the landscape there in Rennes-le-Château. Specifically, it was a couple mountains, Cardu, Blanchefort, and Rennes-le-Château. You can actually see Rennes-le-Château from that vantage point on a little hill. And so that was where Henry Lincoln started on some of the landscape stuff. Now, from there, because of the focus on the pentacle, Henry Lincoln goes deep, deep, deep into some other stuff. Now, we talked about the sacred feminine, the pentacle from there. Henry Lincoln started looking at the way some of this stuff was built in the landscape, and specifically churches. Now, the church at Rennes-le-Château and a couple other churches in the area, as well as some other landscape, and we'll put pictures to all this up online, created a pentacle. So they actually created a giant pentacle on the landscape with the things that they built. And so that was some of the stuff that Henry Lincoln got into. That's certainly not all he's done, but I would say even more than Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that is the research that Lincoln's done that is just his. He co-wrote Holy Blood, Holy Grail with two other authors, but the pentacular geometry and sacred geometry from the landscape was his, and so he found that stuff. So there's a lot of places to go from there, but this is where I jumped in, and I mentioned at the beginning of this episode that I'd be telling my story a little bit with this, and cue up 15-year-old Josh getting into the Da Vinci Code. I think I told my story about how I was going looking for some DVDs and ended up picking up a documentary that explained the story behind the Da Vinci Code and was immediately entranced. I mean, as soon as it ended, I started it over and took notes because I was just so interested in the topic. So over the course of the next few years, I discovered that there are other paintings that look like they might have the same background in it. And now this isn't something that any other researchers have found or anything like that. I've discussed it with some other people and some other researchers, so it's not like it's unknown in the Rennes-le-Château community, but this isn't by any other researcher. This is my findings, essentially. And that basically the background landscape in Shepherds of Arcadia exists in other paintings, but only as a singular image. And what I mean by that is there is a type of painting called a it's most known as is like a triptych. And a triptych would be three paintings that are meant to be viewed together as one scene, although they are separate paintings. And I think it was more popular, I want to say like in the 14, 1500s in Italy, it was more popular as like maybe an altarpiece or something like that. And to my knowledge, there isn't anything like this where there's a hidden image. And in this case, it's four paintings and not three. It'd be a polyptych, you know, many instead of just three. I guess maybe quadriptych would fit as well, but I like polyptych a little better. So anyways, it seems that this mountain, or rather this landscape, appears in other Poussin paintings. And that beyond that, that one of the main paintings is also another mountain in the area. You know, Henry Lincoln theorized that Cardu, Blanchefort, and Rennes-le-Château were a part of it, but where I jumped in was theorizing that another mountain called Bougrush, Pic de Bougrush, was also in the painting as well. And that's where we get the mysterious mountain that starts jumping into things, which is Bugrush. And that it took me a few years to get to that point, and I didn't do it right away. When after I had found the first two, I really wanted to start working with other people. And you know, just to give people context, this is when I was 18 or 19 years old. I mean, or younger when I found this. So it wasn't like I had any kind of credentials or anything. I just wanted to write people and say, hey, you know, I found this stuff. And then in about 2009 or so, about 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, which I've mentioned on the show. I haven't talked about it a lot, but I have mentioned it. And because I got cancer, this whole Renle Chateau research, this whole Holy Grail thing took on another... It kind of manifested itself in a different way for me, because I went from thinking I found something cool in some paintings to thinking, man, if I pass away from cancer, nobody's going to know about this, and it might be lost for another 300 years. And I mean, probably a little, probably need to be a little more humble about it, because in thinking I found it when nobody else had. But, you know, either way, I felt that it was important and that I needed to talk to people about it. So I started reaching out more to people who might be associated with Renle Chateau research. And I didn't get a ton of hits or anything. I emailed some people, but I did get a hit back from Andrew Goff. He is a TV personality. You can probably find it. If you're into History Channel and, alternative history type stuff, you might have seen him. He's a pretty prominent TV personality who's done quite a few different things. And I emailed him about it just to get his idea. At this point, I wasn't trying to do anything except just tell people about it. So I emailed Andy, and he wrote back and said, this is great. I love it. Let's tell the world about it. How about you write an article for my site? So I did. So I wrote an article for Andy's site. And to be honest, because of what I thought I had found, I expected it to blow up. I expected to be able to put it out there and it would spread like wildfire and it would be the next big thing in Renle Chateau research. And it wasn't really. It was kind of, you know, its own little corner of the internet. And, you know, we had people talking about it on Andy's forums, on his site and stuff, but it wasn't huge. From there, it did actually lead to me getting contacted by a couple other people. One was filmmaker Bruce Burgess. We mentioned him. He made the Bloodline documentary. I want to say 2006 was when that was released. I might be wrong about that. But Bruce Burgess emailed me after I had tried contacting him before. And then there was another researcher as well. And I don't – because he's known for other research and seems like he might be more prominent in that area, I don't want to mention him without his permission. So I'm not going to talk too much about him. But actually, he got in contact with me through Andy. And for the next couple of years, he and I corresponded back and forth. And actually, I reconnected with him recently. And part of the inspiration for doing this show and revisiting my old research was getting in contact with him. And like I said, I don't want to give too much information about him without his permission, but I'll see if that's, talking about our correspondence and our collected research is something he'd be interested in letting me talk about on the show. So short story long, that's how I got into the Renle Chateau community. I had that article published on Andy's site and was connected to researchers through there.
And that link will also be in the show notes.
Yes. Well, actually, the article's not up on Andy's site anymore. I mean, he's redone his site.
I just found it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't up for a long time.
Yep.
I'm pleasantly surprised.
And I emailed it to Chasing Shadows.
Oh, great. I actually have a copy because when he changed his site and took off the guest articles, I emailed him for a copy. So we also have a Word doc copy. So we'll put the link up. I mean, man, this is a blast from the past seeing this, but we'll put a link up to that. For the little article that I wrote about it called Poussin's Mountainous Mystery. And that's how I jumped into the research community. After that, there was a lot and nothing at all at the same time. I did some collective research with some other people online and corresponded back and forth with some other people who were doing their own private research. But from there, I actually had a phone call with Bruce Burgess. And he was talking about trying to put something together for us to go over to Renle Chateau and do some research. And he mentioned that he knew some donors who were interested in research on the topic, and he'd get a hold of them and see if they could fund something for us. Unfortunately, that was about a month before Ben Hammett, the Tomb Man, for those of you who have listened to the other episode or seen the Bloodline documentary, he was found to have been hoaxing a majority of, well, all the stuff he was doing, and he was the feature of Bruce's documentary about the topic. So it was very, very unfortunate timing for me, because there was not really going to be a research expedition that I went on with Bruce after, you know, the main topic of his documentary had been found to be a hoax. So that ended up not happening. It was a little bit disappointing, but, you know, it is what it is. One of the cool things to come out of that, though, was a connection to somebody else. Now, we're going through all this stuff. This is still kind of brushing the surface on all of this, and I know it seems like that might be crazy, but it really is. One of the things that Bruce and I talked about when he called me was that there was some recent graffiti on a mural by a French artist named Jean Cocteau. And Jean Cocteau he did a lot of stuff. He was an actor, a philanthropist, I believe. He he's just kind of an eccentric personality, a writer, and beyond that, he was listed as one of the grandmasters of the Priory of Sion in recent years. So actually, I believe it's directly before Pierre Plantard. He was actually listed as a grandmaster of the Priory of Sion. And so when Bruce and I were talking, he mentioned some graffiti that was on a mural by Jean Cocteau. And that just kind of led to do more research on him. And gosh, I'm brushing over all this stuff. I could go so deep on all of this, but it seemed to have connections to some of the things that were involved with decoding the Poussin riddle. And seemed to maybe connect to some of the tombstones that were needed. I didn't even explain how they decoded the riddle, which was an incredibly complicated series of moves called the Knight's Tour, because a knight on a chessboard can hit every single spot if it moves in a certain pattern. And that was the pattern you had to follow to decode the riddle, on top of many other things. No, it was crazy. Basically, you had to have the word mort épée, which is death sword, and that was taken like from a book of gravestones from the area that was like, you had to take that from one of those gravestones, you know, use this substitution cipher, put that into what the parchments were on, then use that to run through the Knight's Tour on a chessboard and pull out the letters, and then you had this riddle. What? Like, it was so incredibly crazy and complex that there's no way it was not intentional to these parchments.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you also had to know what you were doing to be able to decode it, and that's one of the thoughts about maybe that's why the author reached out to Henry Lincoln. Because there's no way he's going to find it without it, you know. Yeah. So, to me, that almost supports that they made up the riddle, you know, and we're basing all this research of it. But I think that's one of the reasons I looked into the painters and less into the modern-day priory. Because you can't fake the paintings. You can't fake the paintings if there's something interesting about them. So that's what I kind of clung to. So, I did a couple different things. I did some stuff locally with some other people who were doing some media, you know. There was talks of different projects and stuff. I will say this. I did try and do, I tried to do a Kickstarter movie and tried to fund a documentary, making my own documentary through Kickstarter and Indiegogo. And, you know, I was not by any means qualified for that. You know, I wasn't qualified to take a bunch of money from people to make a movie. But, even after the first time I had cancer again after that, 2 years later. And I think when I did those projects, it was more about wanting to do something. I was just so desperate to do something with the research on this topic. Because, you know, here's this mystery over in France. And I'm over here living on the west coast of the United States. I still have never been to Redland Chateau. You know, I've never been there. I've done all my research from a computer. You know, and it's only because we live in the digital age that I was able to do that. And, I just wanted to do something. And so when, you know, these different platforms came out, I thought, hey, maybe I could do something with that. I couldn't, but it was just trying, you know. And ultimately, those projects were early on kind of really what led to this, is because I didn't want to give up in doing projects. And so, you know, over time, it evolved from just doing the topic of Redland Chateau to then doing different things, because I always had interest in different things as well. So that's what kind of one of the things that led to the show. And when I was talking about producer Bree, one of the things I was telling her about when we kind of came up with the show. So beyond that, I just wanted to give a shout out to good old co-host Eric McLean, because throughout the years I had those two projects I mentioned, and those were not the only ones. And I would always come to him because he was a movie guy and say, hey, bud, you in for this project? You want to tag along if I can make it work? And I'll be damned if not every single time Eric said, I'm in. He always said, I'm in. And as he did for this project as well. So I just want to give a quick call out to good old E for always being there on my crazy ideas and crazy projects. And that kind of leads us to now in the last couple years. I have not done a ton of research into the paintings lately, although I haven't given up. I also have come to the conclusion that it's likely that those things aren't there, that there's a 50-50 chance that it's pareidolia, and that it's not the same landscape that's in Shepherds of Arcadia, and from there, not the same landscape that's in Rennes Chateau. But I can't give it up. I cannot let it go, and I still, you know, still cling to it and hope that in the future I can talk with some art experts and do a real deep dive into those four paintings like Henry Lincoln did with the Shepherds of Arcadia to see and really get to the bottom of whether or not those paintings have anything worthwhile in them in regards to having a connected image in the background landscape.
Well, and also, we do have plans in the nearish future to go to Rennes Le Chateau.
Yes, I just said we've never been there, but we are, producer Bree and I are planning on going there next year together. Yeah. So,
you can see for yourself, go to all the vantage points.
Yes, and I'm so excited for that. So, that will be a trip to France next year. And I say I haven't been there yet, and I'm so excited for that trip. So you can bet that we will have some great on-site episodes for that and some great follow-up and media to share in regards to our trip to Rennes Le Chateau. So watch out for that in the future. For the more recent stuff, we're so far past our time already, and there's so many more things I wanted to talk about still, and mostly in regards to Bugrush, because if that is a connected image, then Bugrush is the mountain that is in the painting. Now, I mentioned that there wasn't only one David Teniers. There's also more than one Poussin that painted, and that's actually, that's not that super well known. But, okay, now here's where it gets a little bit weird. Gaspard Duguet was his name.
Okay.
And he married Nicholas Poussin's sister.
Mm-hmm.
He took the surname Poussin.
Okay.
So his painting, or his rather, the name that he painted under was Gaspard Poussin. So there was another Poussin. And let me tell you, you can bet that he painted landscape paintings, and one of his paintings actually looks like it has Bugrush in it as well. And that one is actually the most concrete to me of all of them. So we've got another Poussin who's painted images of mountains that seem to be the same painting that is in the landscape over there at Rennes Le Chateau that Poussin may have put at least into the Shepherds of Arcadia and maybe even into more paintings, if my theories are correct. So we're a few words into this. Shepherdess, no temptation, that Poussin Teniers. That's all we visited in this riddle so far. Six words? We're already that deep. We're already that deep on going into this and the paintings and all of that.
There's so many tangents, like you said. Like, then there's another Poussin, there's another Teniers, like all these different things. And, you know, maybe it's something even more obscure than that, you know, like... Just more and more down the rabbit hole.
The rabbit hole is so, so deep. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to touch on for this episode, because it's very clear that there's so much more. The last thing I wanted to talk about was Bugrush. Because once I started looking at Bugrush specifically, that's when things started to get even weirder. And that is when there started to be more characters and more people involved with the whole mystery of the area getting involved. So there might not be many people in America who recognize the name of the mountain. If you're from Europe, you might very well have heard of it, though, because it was a famous mountain. In 2012, people flocked there because they believed that that was the safe place to go for the Mayan apocalypse. December 21st, 2012, when everybody thought the world was going to end.
Why was that the safe place?
There wasn't a good reason. I can't think of like a specific reason. It was just like, oh yeah, this is the place to go. It's a UFO hotspot.
Maybe the aliens were going to come and pick them up and be like, we believe in you, save us.
Sure, maybe. And, you know, if you dig deep, you could probably get... I know there's a documentary online. It's all in French about the mountain itself and why...
I feel like I have to find that out.
Yeah, and why so many people were interested in it and thought it was a safe space for the 2012 apocalypse. But other than that, it's a UFO hotspot. It shows up, you know, with UFO articles from time to time. And particularly in the, this is the part where I was most interested, was that there was supposed to be, and now my sources online for this guy are all just online stuff about Rennes Le Château, but there was a guy named Daniel Bedix, and it's a very interesting story. He was a Swiss security officer. He worked at the Geneva Airport, but in his free time, he researched medieval Cathar tragedy. Now, we're kind of connecting back to Otto Rahn and some of the research that he did with the Cathars and Montségur in the area. So he also did research in Cathar, the Cathars. And he was involved with the French Society of Cathar Research. And he had a very specific document that he had. I would love to get my hands on this document. I have never been able to find it, but I would love to get my hands on this document. And what it was, I believe it was like an academic writing. Maybe it's like somebody from a local college or something. Maybe a big one. Maybe not even a local one. But the document was called Mémoire sur la mythologie appliquée à Pêche de Thos, or Memory of the Mythology of Pêche de Thos, the old name for Bougrush. Basically, it kind of gave a history of mythical and legendary writings with some 15th century sources, I believe it was. And it dealt with underground entrances to caves and the story of Agartha, quote unquote, where it was like an underground mythical world. And in his notes, he speaks of a tradition of a hidden opening leading to a waterway. All right. So Bedix believed something was going on. Now, there was one person he had contact with who he said that, you know, he kind of gave updates. And what he believed was that there was something buried there. And there was even a correspondence he had in 1988, same year I was born, weird connections to my birth. So it's 1988, and he was, you know, normally, allegedly, a calm guy. And he called his contact. His name was Lucienne. And he called her and said he is almost at the end of his search. In 4 or 5 days, he will be there. He will find what he's looking for. And he even told her, you will be immensely rich. According to the articles and the sources that tell this story online, he was found dead 3 days later, either in or close to the mountain. From the online sources that I can find, it says that there's no cause of death, but there's rumors that he died in a collapsed gallery in the mountains. Some say he died of a heart attack. Some say that they found his dehydrated body near the mountain. But there's rumors about what happened. From the sources online, even says that, you know, maybe he returned to Switzerland and died peacefully. But either way, the legend exists, and it's really important to note that there are cave systems littering the area. Bougrush is made of limestone. Some of the biggest and most numerous cave systems in the world. And not only that, but some of the oldest. The Lascaux Caves with the cave art. I believe there was a documentary by Werner Herzog called The Cave of Forgotten Dreams about those caves. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of year old caves with cave art in them. Some where the government won't even tell people where it is because they want to keep it safe. That's not that far away from this area. Caves are huge in this area. So it's very possible that he found a cave system and thought he was going to find something there. Now, Daniel Bedix, I'll fully admit, the sources I've seen online are few and far between, and I don't have any actual documentation for it. In terms of evidence, there's not really any good evidence for it. But it's little stories like this, little weird connections, little weird bits of research that seem to connect each other that keep me personally coming back and saying, okay, what's the underlying connection here? What's going on here? You know, and even today, there's weird stuff. Like, there was a documentary that came out a couple years ago called The Other World, where two people claimed to go back in time near, I believe it was either Chateau de Blanchefort or Montségur itself, where they actually, they're making claims that they went back in time and saw, you know, Marie de Blanchefort, the white lady of the keep, you know, that came to visit them. And
were they tested for drugs?
Well,
I just know that kind of area and the surrounding areas are kind of known for hippies and spiritualists. No,
you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's funny. They actually put a guy in their movie from the area who's kind of a well-known personality, but he's kind of a crazy guy.
I love it.
Like, you watch him and, like, you almost feel like, oh, people are taking advantage of this guy because he kind of seems to have a little bit of mental illness. I don't know. It's bordering on eccentrism and potential mental illness. Mm-hmm. And he's actually featured in the Booger Rush documentary I mentioned earlier, as well as The Other World. But there are a lot of, yeah, people who are considered maybe hippies or...
Or took one too many acid tabs.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. And it's hard to filter out that stuff along with the other stuff. Yeah. And so that's just some of the stuff that has been going on. For me personally, a couple years after my non-expedition with Bruce, he made a TV show, I want to say on the Yesterday Channel in the UK, called Forbidden History. And he did an episode on Rennes Le Château. He asked me to be in it. And I was all set to do the interview. But as it happens, they had far too much material. And so I got a little bit of a letdown again on that one from Bruce, that I didn't get to be involved with the project. But in that episode of that show, he focuses on some people who are going in caves in the area. You know, and in his documentary Bloodline as well, there are people going into caves in the area looking at like large megalithic stones that weigh over 10,000 pounds that look like they were made for a structure. You know, and there's all kinds of theories about there being underground temples, underground cave systems. Just so much. It's so much. It's so deep. And
well, and it's so hard because the way that things are going now, and with the way that geology can change the landscape,
yes,
that might be something that won't be able to ever be found until a society who views our society, or rather that society, as like ancient Egyptians type thing.
Sure.
Do those kind of archaeological, because right now people live there. Like, they're not going to like totally go full force into it.
Right. And that's part of the problem with Bugrush, is there's a lot of private property around it. So if there's a cave entrance on private property, you can't get to it legally.
Yeah. In our show notes, I'm going to post an article from The Guardian talking about that whole doomsday thing.
Oh, yeah.
Which there's several interesting things. When we were sitting here, I kind of went through and I was like, what the heck? But
yeah.
A lot of the article was about people who live there complaining about everyone coming there. Because it's small little French town.
And it's tiny.
And they have, you know, people like those hippies and spiritualists, that they kind of know it's an area that you're going to have some tourism to. You know, you're going to have some tourism.
But these are like pilgrimages.
Yeah, but that's excessive.
Specifically to, you know, be safe at the end of the world.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, too, was someone from the city. I don't remember if it was a public official or just somebody who lives there. I imagine a public official. But it stated that, like, at the time of the interview, the sign for the city of Bucharest had been stolen three times.
Yeah, right. Because it's just a town and the mountain. The mountain's called the mountain's called Pic de Bucharest, and the town's Bucharest.
Yeah. And so he was just like, it costs a lot of money. Like,
Right.
Come on.
It's like hotels who have to get rid of their 420 room signs because they get stolen all the time, or you know, street signs that are specific names of people, you know, like, wow, this is not feasible to just be normal here.
Like, it's cool. It takes out of the taxes, so.
Yeah, right.
Complain about that pothole, but you stole the sign. You don't really get much to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
But in that same context, you know, even if the pilgrimage of people going there was so disruptive, they're not going to start, you know, digging into these caves that are still very much a part of the society there, I imagine.
Yeah,
you know, that's like if somebody came here and was like, oh, yeah, there might be something at Nome Falls. We're just going to start digging into it.
We'd
be like, excuse you. No, you're not.
Yeah. But even then, there's known cave systems that are huge. Font de Dots, that's a cave system in the area. We'll post a link to a video of some people caving in that, which is on YouTube. You can search it, but we'll put it in the show notes. Huge caves. I mean, we're talking just cave systems that are massive. And it just, you know, makes it very, very interesting that if nothing else, there may be some people who use them as repositories in the past.
Yeah.
And I think in all of this, that's kind of where I ended up. You know, there's a lot of people who make very big claims about what's there. People claim the body of Mary Magdalene's there. They claim, you know, that seems to be what the Da Vinci Code is talking about. You know, that's what Ben Hammett was lying about and, you know, said he found the body of Mary Magdalene. There's, you know, these people there are lots of people who have theories about what's there. Otto Rahn, you know, had ideas about the Cathars. Henry Lincoln has ideas about what's there, you know, and the sacred geometry and what's going on there. You know, there's just so many different things going on here. And we're still just brushing the surface. You know, Pierre Plantard was supposed to be the person who was the perpetrator of the Prior of Sion hoax, quote unquote, and the dossier sacré that was in the French National Library. He's got somebody running around who's claiming to be his son these days. I've actually had a little bit of interaction with people he was associated with. And there's people who, you know, that have very interesting connections. This all still goes till today. The graffiti that was on the Cocteau mural was just a few years ago. So at the very least, there are people who believe there are very important things mm-hmm. going on here. And that can be powerful in and of itself,
yeah.
even if there's not actually anything going on, yeah. that there are people who believe there is something going on here.
Oh, yeah. It's so interesting that I wish that I could start training today to become a cave excavator and
sure.
all that stuff.
Sure.
But then there are movies like As Above, So Below, where I will never, cave. Ever do that.
Yeah, right.
Never.
Just the thought of getting stuck in a cave. It's so intriguing.
Exactly. And I'm sure, I mean, I'd love to do the research to figure out, but I'm sure that people have died trying to find these things.
Oh, absolutely. Well, if the Daniel Bedick story is true, then there's one right there.
Yeah.
Daniel Bedick,
yeah.
you know? And there's so many things with this area. We haven't even talked about the geology of Bugarush. That mountain's called the Upside Down Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Because on top of the mountain, you can find rocks and minerals that are older than the rocks and minerals beneath on lower parts or underneath that mountain, which, you know, there are geological explanations for in terms of, you know, plate tectonics and stuff moving, you know, in and around each other. That's not necessarily saying that the mountain has been upended or anything like that, but, you know, also stuff like compasses or electronics not working correctly on the mountain. There's just all these little things that add up that seem to say there is something going on here. And whether or not that is just about the people who are researching it and the people who live in the area who are perpetuating this idea, maybe for tourism, maybe for their own purposes, or whether it is actually something going on there, this topic just keeps going. And even when it seems like it's over, there's more to be found.
Yeah.
And there's more to be looked at and new leads to be examined. And, you know, whether or not the Prior of Sion is a real organization throughout history, there are people since the 1970s that have claimed to be part of the Prior of Sion. And there are people still today who claim to be part of the Prior of Sion. And, you know, if there's things going on like graffiti that looks like it's coded messages to other members of the Priory that were made, that, you know, that were written on a mural of a past grandmaster, why would somebody do that if there's no attention on it at all? What's the point? So ultimately, just to wrap up the stuff that we've talked about today, I think where I landed with the whole thing is that I don't believe that there is anything of significance to a particular religion there. Meaning, I don't think that there's the body of Jesus or the body of Mary Magdalene buried near in the chateau or under Bugarush. I don't believe that that's the case. What I do believe is that there's enough caves in the area and there have been enough large organizations, enough organizations that have, you know, existed throughout history, that there may be something there that was used as a repository. And I guess to be cheesy about it, it's kind of like National Treasure, where over the course of time, you know, there's just more and more added to it. And if it was a place where people thought that they could store things safely throughout the ages, no matter what was going on in the world, then that might have been added to over time. And the importance and the significance of the things there might have gotten more and more as time went on. So ultimately, you know, like I said, I think it's a 50-50 chance that it's nothing or that it's something. And even if it is something, I don't think it's as crazy as, you know, the body of deities, literally. But it seems like there's something going on there that I just can't let go. And, you know, this episode is kind of different than a lot of the ones we've done. You know, we'll do a chasing shadows topic and say, hey, are we chasing shadows on this? Look, if I'm talking to the listeners and saying, is there good evidence for anything being at Rennes Le Chateau? Is there solid evidence that we can count on that we can say we're not chasing shadows? I say no. I'd say, if you look at Rennes Le Chateau, the Rennes Le Chateau topic, at the Bugarush topic, I would say that what the evidence would suggest in terms of its validity, that we are just chasing shadows. But I can't let it go still.
I was going to say, that's a big thing for you
I know. It is a very big thing for me to say. And, you know, some people that know me might be surprised to hear that. But I don't think that there is enough evidence to support there being something there. That being said, the connections to the past, the connections now, and all of the things that are being researched and all of the things that have these odd little connections seem to suggest that there may be something going on here. I think it's just simply a repository for historical artifacts.
Well, and it could have been something that it was that, or it held something at one point in time.
Right.
And has since moved. But
yeah, maybe it doesn't now.
And if all the original stuff is still pointing to that region, yet it was moved by an individual or an organization, you know, who knows if they made additional codes mm-hmm. or if it's just something right. that's like word of mouth known mm-hmm. within a secret society that, mm-hmm. you know, if you tell it, you'll get killed.
Yeah.
And then it'll move again. And,
oh, yeah.
you know, they could continue searching forever and ever.
Yeah.
Or who knows if in, you know, 20 years, somebody finds something and mm-hmm. there's a tablet there mm-hmm. or yeah. there's, you know, another yeah. code yeah. that leads to another thing.
Well, yeah. And we haven't even talked about the fact that if the Priory of Sion has existed, then there may be more than just Poussin who's put stuff into their works.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Jules Verne, in his book, he has a book where there is somebody named Captain Bugrush. And he's also the person who wrote Journey to the Center of the Earth about, you know, underground stuff, you know, mm-hmm. underground cave systems that are huge, expansive, you know, obviously yeah. much more hyperbolic, yeah. you know, and exaggerated than in these cases. But that's not even considering stuff like John Cocteau maybe putting stuff in his works that are codes, or writers, or other authors. Some people believe that William Shakespeare was not a person, but a group of people writing books that had these same types of codes in them. Yeah. So this topic is so, so big. And at first it seems small, like, oh yeah, this is the Da Vinci Code. It's nothing big. But as soon as you get into it, it is just huge.
Well, and it's so hard because I've mentioned it before on another episode of ours, but as humans, we have a tendency towards patternicity, finding patterns in things. It's what we have evolved to do.
Yeah.
It's something that we do every day without realizing mm-hmm. it, even beyond conspiracy theories, just tiny sure. things. Like you're watching somebody, they're walking their dog. The dog looks a little hairy because of every other time you've seen the dog be hairy or, you know, act funky. You're like, oh, this dog is going to jump on me. And so you then make the decision, do I cross the street or do I keep walking? And if that dog jumps on you like you thought, that adds to the pattern. Next time you're probably going to cross the street.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so in looking at these things, it's hard to try and not get so sucked into each thing.
Yeah.
Because you could look at, you know, all of the people that we've talked about so far and all of their works, and we can probably, even if the codes are there and the messages are there, we'll probably find 10... You know, more things.
10 different patterns or 10 different connections.
That aren't there.
And we might be, exactly. We might be starting to create connections.
Exactly.
We might be starting to create patterns. And I think that's one of the reasons I have shied away from the topic but have come back to it recently is because it started to feel like I was creating connections or creating mm-hmm. patterns. And ultimately, for me, that is the birth of the show for me. Is because mm-hmm. I was at a point with this topic where I want to say, no, I need good evidence. I can't in good conscience believe that this is real, because I did. I believed it was real. I can't in good conscience believe that this is real without good evidence. And then that started trickling over to other topics that mm-hmm. I was interested in. Bigfoot was a big one.
Yeah.
You know, started trickling over to that. And then it became like all of this stuff, all of these things that we've been talking about on the show. Is there good evidence for it? Because if not, I've spent so much time doing it. I don't want to waste any more.
But we also, I mean, you and I, us talking has kind of been the birth of it too, you know, and going back and forth.
Oh, absolutely.
And
that's the birth of my mindset for the show.
For sure,
yeah, not actually
for
the birth of the show.
No. I'm just meaning we do a really good job when we talk about things to be that side for the other person.
Right.
And I think one of the important things that you've kind of touched on is even though you don't necessarily believe these things still as you have in the past, it's okay to continue on with them
sure.
as long as you understand what it is and what
right.
it isn't.
I know that it might be nothing.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for these things knowing it might be nothing.
Exactly. And so, you know, who knows? You might go home tonight, do a little bit more research just because we've been on the topic, and then move
Boom,
on.
Boom, there it is. I thought you were going to say find it. Like, oh, there it is. There's the connection I was waiting for.
No.
Oh, boy. Uh-oh.
I'm just meaning, you know, it's, you can give more intentional parts of yourself to it, sure, as opposed to letting it consume you. Not saying that you had by any means,
right?
But as far as, you know, for somebody, for example, who believes in Bigfoot, they might go around hunting all the time and like neglect other responsibilities to try and find Bigfoot.
Right.
But if, you know, like us, we've already talked, we don't believe that there's a Bigfoot, but if we're in somewhere where there's Bigfoot stuff, you might bring our camera just in case.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and that's not to say that believing in something wouldn't stop us from exploring something. If we were in the woods and we saw something that looked like Bigfoot, we'd go after it.
Yeah.
We'd go look and see what it was, and we'd collect
the evidence. I would probably shy away from that. I could get thrown like a freaking hacky sack.
Right, but it wouldn't stop us from believing it if there was good evidence.
Exactly. You know? We still keep an open mind to things.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, like you said, that's an important part of it, is how much time and how much of yourself you put into it.
So from all the things we've talked about today, the Cathars, Autoron, the Prior of Sion, Gerard de Sede, Philip de Chiracy, Pierre Plantard, Daniel Bedix, Henry Lincoln, Bruce Burgess, even. Mm-hmm. All of these people have been bit by the same bug. And all of those people have seen this topic and thought, I want to know more. And that's what I think when looking at these topics is important to do, is know that when you're looking at paranormal, mysterious, or supernatural topics, things might not be real, and you have to go into it with that mindset. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a little cheesy specifically about the Holy Grail, because people will say when you look at the Holy Grail, it's not about the treasure. It's not about the end goal. It's about the journey. And the journey will, you know, make you into something that is more important than actually finding treasure. Mm-hmm. And that has been the case for me, in that my journey with Rennes Le Chateau, all my research into it, my beliefs about it, my lack of beliefs, my disappointments, my excitements, all of those things helped shape who I am and how I believe and how I believe things, and partially have contributed to us creating this show. So that's one of the reasons we want to share today.
I think a big part is not just, you know, who you are, but who you are as a member of society and community. You've reached out to people across the world about this.
And still do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it brings people together. It, you know, inspired us to do this radio show where we're doing the same thing. I mean, you know, we obviously are... Yeah. On KXRW and X-Ray FM here locally, but we have the podcast and stuff.
We have people listening all over the world to our podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. That's just something I think that is so universal, is just finding those little things, you know, to just believe. I mean, things can get so monotonous in life trying to find something.
And there's so many people trying to get, there's so many people trying to get you to believe things that aren't true.
Yeah.
And it's important to be able to wade through that. And, you know, I think that's what the show is us inviting you listeners to investigate with us.
Exactly.
So I want to thank you guys for sticking around through this one. This has been a deep one. And I've said it probably 5 times already. I'm going to say it one more time. We are still just brushing the surface on Rennes Le Chateau and Bougrush. We're still just brushing the surface. There's so much more. There's so much more. The modern day priory is a big one. The Red Serpent, which was another big, like, 13-paragraph riddle that was in the Dossier Sacré. I could keep going on. I could keep going on and list things over and over. The Knights Templar, the historical Prior of Sion, Da Vinci, you know, all of those things I could keep going on. So this is a topic that we'll keep coming back to.
And I think it's important to note, too, that since we're having so many of these topics that we're going back to on our website, you know, we've got all of the episodes listed individually, but as we start creating more on the same topics, we're going to create pages so you can go by topic.
We want to be able to browse by topic. That was pretty important for us to be able to do.
Exactly. So that way, you know, we'll have these series where it's like Da Vinci Code, you know, the beginning, Da Vinci Code, and all these different things. Mm-hmm. And so that way you can follow it because, like Josh mentioned, even though he knows so much about this, we're still learning new things. And that's going to be the way it continues for all of these topics.
Absolutely. Yeah. So thank you guys for investigating with us today. This has been a big one. Bree, before we go, we need to answer the question. We have gone beyond the Da Vinci Code today. When we when we looked at the Da Vinci Code, we said that there was not any good information in the Da Vinci Code that would suggest that Da Vinci hid any codes in his painting, any hidden messages in his painting that we could see from the information from that movie. We've gone beyond that now. We've gone into Rin Le Chateau and the story it's based off of. So the question is, are we just chasing shadows? Is there treasure at Rin Le Chateau?
I don't know. And see, maybe it's just me because of my perspective that I've had on treasures and treasure hunts and all that kind of stuff too. I feel like if there was something, it would be more about information than like a tangible thing.
Oh, sure. I agree completely.
And yeah. I, you know, that's one of those things too where I'm like, okay, so is it in the information that you learn along the way? Is it something that you were supposed to lead it to somebody and they thought somebody would crack it before and they have it and now that person's dead?
Right.
Or is it some documents? Like, I feel like if it was, it would be some form of information, not even necessarily about the bloodline, but just something.
Something.
I don't know how that relates into the wealth that he got. I don't know if he was blackmailing somebody.
Talking about the priest, Baron J. Sonier.
Yes. You know, I don't know what it is. I mean, I definitely think that there was very intentional clues left behind about something.
Yes.
Who knows? Maybe they just thought that Sonier was corrupt, and so they were trying to find ways to be like, hey, this dude's corrupt, but without outing him, because maybe he had something. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I feel like, I know, but then again, you said that you don't know if that riddle was even right or if they just made it up. And that's
if
one
it was just a
so
creation
hard.
By Gerard de Sede and Philip de Chercy.
Like in the Curse of Oak Island thing, like we talked about how literally watching the show and seeing these guys who had done this research since they were young boys because they had been around when people had been dying and, you know, all the strange stuff was happening. Yeah. They even said that they try and leave like wrong clues for each other.
That if they were searching for it and they knew other people were, that they might be motivated to leave clues that were incorrect. And how much of that is happening around the chateau?
Yeah.
Because after I wrote my article for Andy's site, Bruce emailed me, and his email was, hey, listen, there's a lot of people who want you to believe a lot of things about this. Be careful what you believe.
Gah.
And that's where we're at. And so if I had to answer, if I were to say right now, are we chasing shadows on Rin Le Chateau? Is there any evidence there's a treasure there? No. I would say we're chasing shadows. But that's not the end of the story. Because if you were to ask the question a little differently and say, are there people leaving clues that point to Rin Le Chateau?
Yes.
And there are interesting things that happen in the area that are kind of unexplained? I would say yes. Yeah. We're not chasing shadows.
So we're going to climb Boogerush and either find out the hidden treasure or see a UFO.
We will certainly. I am so looking forward to that trip. And we will absolutely include all the people investigating with us through the show in that investigation.
Yes.
So if you enjoyed our episode today, it's a long one. It's longer than most of our episodes.
Sorry.
So sorry about that. I hope you stuck through. If you didn't, then, you know.
We understand.
Then we understand. Absolutely, we understand. But this is a little bit longer episode, which was completely unexpected. But going into this, we wanted to give it some justice. And I don't think we fully did. There's still so much more to go, but we'll have to save it for another day. So, Bree, thank you for being my co-host today. I appreciate it so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. Yeah. I know we've talked about this a lot together, and I'm even learning new things as we go along.
Yeah, yeah. And next week, we will have McLean and Bane back with us. McLean and Bane back with us. We will be doing some episodes with another guest host. We're jumping back to aliens again. So, yeah, aliens and UFOs in South America. So keep an eye out, or rather keep an ear out for that. And like we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, just to touch on it again, we are working on revamping our social media. And we are building our website. You can visit it now, but it won't be fully built until the end of the month. So by September, we will have fully revamped social media, fully up-to-date website, show notes, pictures, you know, audio,
all the works.
We love that the show is growing so quickly. We want to thank all of our listeners for that. If you're listening, whatever channel you're listening on, if you guys subscribe, listen, share it with your friends. If you've got people who are interested in these type of topics, then please spread the word because we are growing quickly and we want to continue to do that. So thank you for helping us do that. And we're glad that you guys are all along for the ride in investigating with us. If you want to write to us, if you have something you guys want to say, something suggest, some of your own research that you'd like to share with us, you can send your handwritten letters to chasingshadowspodcast@gmail.com. Otherwise, you can visit our website at www.chasingshadowsradio.com. Otherwise, I think that's it for us. Bye.